Okay, it is a pleasure to be here. Last time I was in Wichita, it was December, and I was speaking to Kansas Livestock, and that was an early morning start after a very late night, so I'm kind of glad I didn't have that issue today. But it is a pleasure to be here. I have to apologize to you right off the bat. As you can hear, I'm not from Kansas. I'm from Arkansas. No, I'm not from Arkansas. Although I did tell some guys from Arkansas. I was at the NCBA summer meeting, and there were some guys who I won't mention by name because some of you almost certainly know them, and I told them that I was from Arkansas, and I think for a whole 30 seconds they actually thought I was, so that was kind of cool. But I'm not from Arkansas. I am from Oxford, England. I've been over here for 6 years, 3 years at Cornell, three years at Washington State, and I just made the move to Bozeman, Montana about 3 months ago now. And I'm totally biased, and I think it's the most beautiful place on the planet, obviously. But this is a subject I'm really passionate about, and I really could talk about this for the next 14 hours, and I'm aware that I am the person between you and the tour, so this is kind of a hard place to be. But my primary aim as a livestock sustainability consultant is to give you guys the tools, the facts, and the talking points to talk back against all these people who are either actively against animal agriculture, so PETA and HSUS and Greenpeace, or simply the people who you talk to at church or at a school function and say, well, isn't beef bad? You know, isn't it killing the planet? Shouldn't I be eating chicken instead or tofu or whatever? So I'm hoping to just give you some of those talking points. Mark said earlier that his was going to be the least technological presentation, and I would argue with that. I think mine is actually the least technological. I have to make a true confession that I hear the word genomics and my brain kind of glazes over because I'm not that smart. But I'm hoping that the stuff that I tell you about will be clear and understandable so that you can take it home and talk about it to anybody you want to talk about it to. So with that, I'm going to give you my definition, and this is only mine, this isn't anybody else's, but my definition of the S word, sustainability. And hopefully that's not a word that I'll have to talk about that much, because we all have our own definition of what that means. And there are as many definitions of it as there are people in this room, or possibly even people in Kansas. But to me, in contrast often to the consumer, or the policymaker, or the retailer, sustainable beef does not mean local, organic, grass-fed, natural, any of these buzzwords that we hear every single day. Sustainable is not confined to niche markets. It's not confined to feeding, you know, 3% to 5% of the market. For me personally, in the field that I've been working in for about 4.5 years now, conventional beef is entirely sustainable. And every sector of conventional beef is sustainable, or rather can be sustainable. And yes, you can have a Highland crossed with an Angus grazed with donkeys in the background. That can be a sustainable beef system. But it depends on three things. As you all know, primarily, possibly before everything else, you've got to be economically viable. If you're not economically viable, you're not going to be here in 6 months, 6 years, 60 years. Economics are the keystone upon which the beef industry is founded. If we don't have that behind us, we're not sustainable. Secondly, we've got to be environmentally responsible. Again, we are charged every single day with destroying the land, killing the atmosphere, being cruel to animals, and so on and so on and so on. And as everybody knows in here, if we didn't take care of the land, the water, of the animals, we wouldn't have a sustainable beef industry that's existed for hundreds of years. But we've also got to be socially acceptable. And we do face this huge understanding gap between the 2% of people who work in ag and the 98% who eat food, of course, every single day, but have no understanding of why we do what we do and why that's important, both to us and to the global population. So what we have done in the beef industry, and again, this has been over the last 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, the beef industry is founded on producing safe, affordable, nutritious beef. We take care of the land, we take care of the water, the air, the resources, the crops, the pastures. The beef industry is socially acceptable in that it gives back to the community every single day. In every rural community, we have beef industry leaders. And I don't mean leaders in terms of NCBA or any other organization. I mean people who are on school boards, who are firefighters, who give back to the community every day. And the beef industry does that particularly well. And having all those things in place is why we have ranchers and farmers who've been in place for three generations, four, five, even six generations sometimes. The beef industry is entirely sustainable and must continue to be so. And one of our biggest strengths that we have as a beef industry, possibly even the biggest, is that we take a heck of a lot of land that we can't use for anything else at all. We take that pasture and that forage and we turn it, again, into safe, affordable, nutritious beef to feed a hungry population. So the beef industry has huge challenges, but as I hope to show you, we've also got huge opportunities as we go forward. And one of our biggest challenges is that we've got an increasing population. According to global estimates, we're going to be about 9.5 billion people. I'm too close to a mic somewhere. Maybe I'll not walk so far. We're going to be at about 9.5 billion people by the year 2050. We just passed the 7 billion mark back in November last year. So we're going to have about 25 to 30% more people in the next 40 years. And if we look at this graph, this is meat consumption going from 1980 on the left to 2050 on the right. Beef is the dark green bars right at the bottom. Pork is the mid-green in the middle. Poultry is the lightest green on the top. The numbers don't matter, but what does matter, as you can see, is that as we have more and more and more people, we obviously need more animal protein, more meat. But if you look at that purple line going down, that's the amount of arable land available per person over that time as well. So we've got more and more and more people. They all want more milk, more meat, and more eggs. But there's less land to grow feed crops. There's less land to grow human food crops. And potentially, there's even less pasture land than we have now. So we're faced with this challenge of more and more and more people, more and more and more meat with fewer resources. So even if you take nothing back from my presentation, I hope you take back that as has been talked about over and over again all day, we've got to improve productivity and we've got to improve efficiency. And it's not just about having more people. This is an advertisement from McDonald's that came out last year because they announced they were going to open 30 McDonald's restaurants in India in 2011. Countries like India, like Africa, like China, where generally at the moment they have far less income than we do here, are going to have more and more income per person. And as we have more income, we want more milk, more meat, and more eggs. So even though we've only got about a 25 to 30% increase in the global population in the next 40 years, to feed those people, we need 70% more food. 70% more milk, meat, and eggs to feed all of them using less water, less land, less resources, and with a lower carbon footprint. So that's one heck of a challenge, right? We have this challenge in front of us, and we're actively challenged every single day by the anti-animal ag groups, the PETA, HSUS, and Greenpeace. And these guys really know the messages that suck. Because if you're driving down the highway, you can see a billboard for a steakhouse, and that's kind of cool, or a furniture store, or whatever. You see a picture of Pamela Anderson in a bikini? That gets a little more notice from most people than a picture of a cow or a steak or a, you know, something else, okay? So they understand that sex sells. The picture that you can see at the top right is a demonstration in Times Square. Those two girls have no clothes on whatsoever and are in a makeshift shower stand. And the shower stand is emblazoned with 1 pound of meat equals 2,463 gallons of water. Now, in Times Square, naked girls are probably not that uncommon in some situations. These girls were also in Bozeman, Montana, about 2 months ago now. They are all over the country. They're being advertising this strong message, and there are two key messages there. The first one in this instance is, we can eat meat or we can shower with a friend. Which is a whole new, you know, ball of wax. But what it also says is that 1 pound of meat, 2,463 gallons of water. It's a really precise number. That's not beef uses lots of water, or beef uses quite a bit of water. 2,463. That sounds precise. That sounds calculated. Somebody sat down and worked it out, right? The fact that that number is total, insert your word of choice here, you know, is, and I won't say the word I was going to say, but the fact that it's total nonsense, for want of a better word, is beside the point. It's out there every single day. It's being advertised in a very effective way and getting to those 98% of people who don't know anything about Animal Ag. So that leads them to think, well, if I care about the planet and my kids and my grandkids and water use, maybe we should eat less beef. Maybe that would, you know, solve the problem for us. And it's not just the obvious anti-animal ag groups. This was a graph from a report that came out from a group called the Environmental Working Group last spring. An environmental working group. Again, it sounds really impartial and scientific. They're just scientists working to make the world better, right? You know, solve all the problems. Well, the graph is the carbon footprint of various food sources. So the big bars that you see on the left, they're lamb, they're beef, they're pork, they're cheese. On the right, those tiny bars are lentils and peas and beans and tofu. Now, if you read their report, it's heavily against animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is bad. We should be vegetarian. We should be vegan in order to save the planet. But this got press internationally. This was fact. You know, beef is killing the world. Lamb is killing the world. We shouldn't be eating this stuff. And it's not just the groups with an agenda. This was a paper that came out in the scientific press a couple of years ago now from Carnegie Mellon University. And in the conclusion of the summary on the front page, they said that shifting less than one day per week's worth of calories from red meat and dairy towards chicken, fish, or vegetable-based foods saves more greenhouse gas emissions than eating a totally local food-based diet. Now, local food is normally characterized as eating food that's been produced within about 100 miles or so of your house. And up until 3 months ago, I lived in Pullman, Washington. And unless you're going to Pullman, Washington, you'll have never been to Pullman, Washington. Let's just kind of leave it at that. And it was a nice place to live. But if I'd eaten local food in Pullman, Washington, I could have eaten peas and lentils and beans, and maybe a little bit of beef, and some Cougar Gold cheese. And that would have been it, basically, you know. No fruit, no coffee, no bananas, no strawberries, no chocolate, any of those things. So we can eat all locally grown food, but there's no control group here. It's meatless one day per week versus all local food. It doesn't put it into context. But it's been adopted universally, almost. If you go to any cafeteria, any hospital, even USDA, back around the time of the NCBA summer meeting, so it would have been about the end of July, beginning of August now, USDA, in their employee newsletter, advised their employees to go meatless every Monday. And when that got leaked out, the backlash from the beef industry was huge, and they took it back really, really, really quickly. But institutions as a whole, schools, cafeterias, hospitals, workplaces, have the impression that if we go meatless one day per week, if we don't eat red meat and dairy one day per week, we're going to save the world, right? Because everybody knows that animals are killing the planet. But are they really killing the planet? Well, if we believe the EPA, and I always have to say if we believe the EPA, because we don't always believe the EPA. But in this instance, I think we do. If we believe the EPA, on a national basis, red meat and dairy account for 3% of our national carbon footprint per year. So 97% comes from everything else, industry, transport, you know, so on and so on. 3%. So at the moment, we're at 313 million people in the States. Everybody from a tiny baby to an elderly person. If every single one of those 313 million people went meatless every Monday for a whole year, that'd have a huge impact, right? That'd save the planet, you know, instantly. Except in terms of our national carbon footprint, it would cut it by less than half of 1%. We would make no difference whatsoever to our carbon footprint, basically, if we all went meatless and dairyless every single Monday. But it's an easy choice, and it's an easy target. Everybody knows that cows make methane every single day. So the easy choice is don't eat beef versus turning off more lights or driving less or using less gas. But it leads to other questions as well. In the spirit of true confessions, when I was 15, I was a vegan. Because as a girl in an English high school, that's what we did. You know, we like to make life difficult for our parents, so we were vegetarian and we were vegan. By the time I was 16, I was eating bacon as if pigs were going out of fashion, you know. Seriously, it was such a relief. But when I was a vegan, age 15, I was passionate about this. This was very important to me. I was very serious about my veganism. If any of you have ever been to England, you'll know the reputation that English food has. Imagine trying to get vegan food in England about 20 years ago. That was quite a challenge. But I had this drive that I wanted my vegan food. I was passionate about consumer choice. So if we turn it the other way, why should our kids, why should all of us not have the choice to eat meat and dairy on a Monday if they want to? Why should that choice be taken away from us? Because there's a perception that going meatless every Monday is going to save the planet. Secondly, as you all know, we don't just get meat from animals. Think about all the leather in all of our boots. Think about the fertilizer. Think about the tallow. Think about the pharmaceuticals. Where are all of those going to come from if we have fewer cows, fewer bulls, fewer heifers on the planet? What's going to replace all of those and at what environmental cost? And perhaps most importantly, what replaces meat and dairy in our diets? You guys are all going to get off on buses in about 45 minutes' time, and I unfortunately can't go because I have to go and do another talk in Lawrence. But you're all going to be sitting on buses for the rest of this afternoon, most of tomorrow, and I think some of Saturday. Friday even. So just imagine what that bus is going to be like by 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, for example. You've had a tofu surprise for breakfast. You've had a lentil and bean casserole for lunch. You've had a lentil-based power bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You may have had some beer, because beer is vegan generally. And then you have a, you know, lovely nut roast with pulses and lentils at dinner time. And you're driving back to the hotel on a bus with 75 other people. People make methane too. It's not just cows. I don't know about you, but I would not want to be on that bus without some kind of breathing apparatus, you know? But we've got to take these things into consideration. It's not just that cows are belching everywhere and killing the planet. If we make a change somewhere, it's going to have implications elsewhere, and we've got to look at it on a whole system approach. So what do we know? Well, this is beef's carbon footprint on a global basis. And as you can see, the bars are up and down all over the place. So the USA are the three bars in black on the left-hand side. Then we've got Canada, we've got Brazil, we've got Sweden, we've got Australia, and we've got Japan. And my take home from this is, don't believe any of that, basically. Not because carbon isn't a fact, not because it isn't important. But the results we get for carbon footprint per pound of beef on a countrywide basis depends entirely on how we analyze it. And at the moment, there's no straightforward analysis that's being used on a global basis. So, for example, here, Australia looks like it's got a really low carbon footprint per pound of beef. The Australian system is grass-based. Those cattle don't really hit the feedlot hardly at all. They take longer to finish. They eat a forage-based diet, which means more methane per animal per day. The fact that there's a published paper saying that Australian beef has a lower carbon footprint than US beef, I find difficult to understand. Let's just put it that way. But it does depend how you analyze it. But what does matter and what is constant? And interestingly, this is data from Australia. But on a global basis, no matter what industry we look at, the biggest component of our carbon footprint occurs from the things that we do on farm. And by that, I mean everything that happens until the animals are slaughtered. So here, if we look at the blue bar, or the blue plus green bar, compared to the height of the orange bar, because the whole bar is the carbon footprint per pound of beef. The blue, or the blue plus green, is the fraction of that that occurs all the way from the cropping inputs to the animal being slaughtered. So what that means is we've got a huge opportunity there, because we could cut the orange bars, which are processing and packaging, in half, and they wouldn't make that much difference to the height of the whole bar overall. But if we cut the size of the blue, or the blue plus green, we make a huge improvement. So what that means is, as a beef industry, we have this huge opportunity to cut total carbon footprint. And we can argue about carbon. You know, is it an issue? Isn't it an issue? You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't taste it. Well, in this case, and in the case with everything else that I talk about, carbon is also a proxy for land, for feed, for water, for fertilizer, for fossil fuels. So whenever I say carbon, also think land, water, fertilizer, and so on and so on. Because it's on farm that we also use most of the water, most of the fertilizer, most of the fuel, and so on and so on. So as an industry, we have a really huge opportunity. So the question is, what have we done? And I'm going to take you back 35 years here to 1977, which is on the left-hand side of the graphs. 2007 is the blue bar, approximately in the middle, and we're projecting out to 2027. And this is hot carcass weight beef per animal over time. So as you can see, since 1977, our animals have got bigger. We've gone from a hot carcass weight of about 603 pounds back in 1977 to 773 pounds in 2007. Question is, how do we keep going? Do we have a situation in 10 or 20 or 30 years' time when we're slaughtering animals at 2,000 pounds, 3,000 pounds, 4,000 pounds? I have a friend who's a butcher in Tennessee, and she posted on Facebook yesterday that they slaughtered an animal who had a hot carcass weight of 1,200 pounds, and it was grass-fed. I have no idea how old this thing was, but, you know, huge, 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 huge animal. But data from the packing and the processing industry at the moment says we can't get that much bigger. At the moment, our average carcass weight is somewhere around 800 pounds per animal. And some of the animals that we're seeing going into the packing plants are too big to fit on the rail. So from a packaging point of view, from a consumer portion size point of view, we can't necessarily have bigger and bigger and bigger animals in beef. But where we have a huge opportunity, and again, we've heard about this earlier, is in terms of productivity and efficiency, in terms of improving average daily gain and growth rate per day. Because for every single day that any beef animal, cow, calf, heifer, bull, steer, whatever, is on the planet, they need feed, they need land, they need water, and they give off greenhouse gases. So if we can shorten the interval from them being born to them being on our plate, we're going to use fewer resources. So again, we're going back to 1977. Because of that increase in carcass weight, because we went from about 600 pounds to about 770 pounds, in 1977, it took us five animals to make the same amount of beef as it took four animals in 2007. So we need to feed and maintain and care for one less animal in 2007 to make the same amount of beef as we did in 1977. Fairly obviously, five animals versus four means five lots of feed, five lots of waste in 1977 compared to four in 2007. So that's really good. But as I say, we can't necessarily continue to make those improvements in carcass weight. But the biggest thing that we have seen over that time is that in 1977, it took about 609 days to get an animal from birth to finishing weight. 2007, that's come down to 485 days. So if we multiply those out, five animals times 609 days compared to four animals times 485 days. 1977 took us just over 3,000 animal days of feed, land, water, fertilizer, and so on and so on to make the same amount of beef as it took us just over 1,900 days in 2007. We've saved 1,100 days worth of feed, land, water, labor, economics, and everything else. So a huge improvement in productivity. But as I said with the previous example, we've got to look at the whole system. We can't just look at one single component of it. And if we do that, if we look at absolutely everything that goes in to making a pound of hot carcass weight beef, so the cropping inputs, the fertilizers, the fuels, the transport, all of the animals, cow, calf, seed stock, backgrounder, feedlot, we end up with this. The purple line at 100% is 1977. The green bars are 2007. So as I said, we've gone from a hot carcass weight of 603 pounds to 773 pounds over that time. 31% increase in carcass weight per animal. That means is in 2007, it took 70% of the animals to make a pound of beef as it did in 1977. Fairly obviously, fewer animals means less feed, 19% less feed per pound of beef. In terms of water use, which, as you all know, at the moment in this drought is absolutely key, we've seen a 12% decrease in water use per pound of beef over that time. And in terms of land use has come down by a third. And that one, again, is really key, because we get challenged every single day that beef uses too much land. We've got all that land that we put beef on that we could use for other things. I had a very energetic discussion with a guy from PETA outside the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. This was about 3.5 years ago now. And he told me with a straight face, if you can grow grass, you can grow corn. And I said, have you ever been to Montana? And he said, no. And I said, oh, okay, that explains it. Because we can't, and we all know that we can't. Yes, on some ground we can grow grass or grow corn. If we've got a rocky hillside with poor soil, with pine trees in it, full of rocks and so on and so on a slope like this, yeah, you could perhaps try and broadcast some corn seed onto it, and you might get, you know, two plants coming up. You're going to harvest it by hand, because there's no other way that's ever going to grow and be harvested. We cannot use the majority of the land that we use for grazing beef for growing anything else. We can't grow artichokes or Brussels sprouts or apples on this land. But we do have an opportunity to turn all that indigestible pasture into safe, affordable, nutritious beef that we all can eat and we all can digest. So even though we're charged with using all of this land, by simply doing what the beef industry does best and has done best, which is to make efficient use of the resources in the most productive way possible, we've cut land use by a third over the last 35 years. Fairly obviously, fewer animals, less feed, means obviously less waste. 18% less waste, 18% less methane. We've got a 12% decrease in nitrous oxide per pound of beef. And the carbon footprint per pound of beef since 1977 has come down by 16%. That's something the beef industry should be really, really proud of, because that wasn't done with the aim of cutting carbon. Who was thinking about carbon 30 years ago, even 5 years ago? It's simply because of improved productivity and improved efficiency over that time, and that's what we've got to carry on over the next 30 years. But we do face quite a challenge, and I really do mean it when I say there's a place for every single system, because every time I do this talk, I offend at least one person, sometimes most people, but often at least one person. There is a place for every system that's socially acceptable and environmentally responsible and economically viable. But there is not a place for mismarketing, in my view. There's not a place for my beef is better than your beef because I don't use technology X, or I do this, or I don't do this. All beef is good as long as it's safe, affordable, and nutritious. But we've got a lot of marketing out there that implies to the consumer that if you're going to eat beef, you should only eat grass-fed beef, for example, or beef that doesn't use productivity-enhancing technologies because that will be better than that bad conventional beef. We've got a quote right at the bottom from my absolutely favourite author, favourite in terms of if I saw him, I'd kick him really hard with my boots, Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan is the guy who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma. He's a journalism professor at UC Berkeley. His book is very easy to understand, very comprehensive, paints a very interesting picture of animal agriculture, not necessarily the picture that we all know and understand every single day. Most of his fame and his and the basis for him being able to talk about this is because he's third-party, unbiased, not paid for by the beef industry, and went into it knowing nothing about animal agriculture whatsoever. On that basis, I'm going to change my profession and write a book on dentistry, because I know nothing about being a dentist, but that means I'm third-party, impartial, and an expert, apparently. So our expert, Michael Pollan, in the New York Times in 2002 now, so 10 years ago now, wrote that we have succeeded in industrializing the beef calf. Not the beef animal, steer, heifer, but the beef calf. You know, cute, small, long eyelashes and so on. Beef calf. Transforming what was once a solar-powered ruminant into the very last thing we need, another fossil fuel machine. Again, to the 98% of consumers who don't understand animal ag, we're taking these poor little babies, ripping them from their mamas, probably, pumping them full of corn and soy and antibiotics and hormones and all this bad stuff that's going to kill the planet and kill our kids. It's a really bleak picture of conventional ag that's often painted. So we did a modelling exercise which we published earlier this year. Again, there is a place for all of these systems. We looked at conventional beef, natural beef, grass-fed beef. Conventional beef is the system that most of you all know. It's the one that makes up 95% of our beef supply in the States. We've got the cow-calf operation, we've got the backgrounder, we've got the feedlot. Calves are weaned at about 7 months. At that point, 15% of them go directly into the feedlot as calf-fed beef. The other 85% go to the backgrounder and then into the feedlot as yearling-fed beef. In the conventional example, we use production-enhancing technologies where approved by the FDA for that class of animal. So what that meant was implants for the stocker and the feedlot. It meant beta agonists in the feedlot, MGA for heifers in the feedlot, and ionophores for stocker animals and for feedlot animals. It didn't include differentiation into antibiotics or parasiticides. Now, in terms of natural beef, there are as many definitions of natural beef as there are people in Wichita. I mean, seriously. Antibiotics, no antibiotics, pasture, no corn, some corn, blah, 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 blah. In this example, natural beef is identical to conventional beef, apart from there are no production-enhancing technologies.